Welcome to The Big Rich Show. This podcast will focus on conversations with friends and acquaintances within the four-wheel drive industry. Many of the people that I will be interviewing, you may know the name, you may know some of the history, but let's get in depth with these people and find out what truly makes them a four-wheel drive enthusiast. So now's the time to sit back, grab a cold one, and enjoy our conversation.
Whether you're crawling the Red Rocks of Moab or hauling your toys to the trail, Maxxis has the tires you can trust for performance and durability. Four wheels or two, Maxxis tires are the choice of champions because they know that whether for work or play, for fun or competition, Maxxis tires deliver. Choose Maxxis. Tread victoriously.
Why should you read Four Low Magazine? Because Four Low Magazine is about your lifestyle, the four-wheel drive adventure lifestyle that we all enjoy. Rock crawling, trail riding, event coverage, vehicle builds, and do-it-yourself tech all in a beautifully presented package. You won't find Four Low on the newsstand rack, so subscribe today and have it delivered to you. On today's episode of Conversations with Big Rich, we have Randy Ellis. That's right, Randy Ellis, the man, the myth, the legend. We are going to talk to Randy about his life in off-road and what he's doing nowadays. Randy, thank you for coming on board and sharing your history with us.
Right on, Rich. Thanks for having me on. It's been a long time since we talked. This should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I will let everybody know that I did screw up this one. I was so excited to talk to Randy. I forgot to hit the record button, and we talked for probably 10 minutes already. So a little bit of this I've already heard, but nobody else out there has heard it. So let's start over again. And Randy, you did say that you were born in Tempe and grew up in that area. So let's go from there.
Yeah, so I was born in Tempe, Arizona, which is basically Phoenix. It's one big metropolitan area, and even much bigger now than it was back then. My parents moved me out to Gilbert when I was about 5 years old, and it was rural, mostly cotton fields and dairy cows and a lot of dirt. There's only one street light. When I say street light, I mean like a red, green, yellow light that hung from a wire back one street. It was the main street of Gilbert Road. But it's a lot different nowadays.
It sure is. It's not rural so much anymore.
No, not at all.
So when you were growing up there and being in a real rural area, you were able to play in the dirt a lot. And that started off with bicycles, or, you know, what'd you start with?
Well, probably like a lot of us in our age group, Tonka trucks.
There you go.
I'm sure you remember those, right?
Oh, yeah. The metal ones, not the plastic.
No, the metal ones where you could actually sit on them. And, I mean, you could beat the heck out of them, but scratch them up, and then I'd fix them up, you know, put some paint on it, make it a different color, make it pretty, and then go tear it up again.
Excellent. And then but, from there?
Well, you know, I moved on to BMX and bicycles and did a little freestyle with bicycles, and I raced BMX and, of course, three-wheelers and dirt bikes, and I'm sure you grew up with some three-wheelers in your time.
Absolutely, yep. I was more pavement.
Yeah, so, yeah?
Yeah, I didn't have a chance for a lot of dirt when I was a kid. I grew up south of San Francisco on the California-San Francisco Peninsula there, but it was a lot of pavement, bicycles and motorcycles and skateboards, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, well, I guess I was lucky to have a lot of dirt. Maybe it steered my ways.
There you go. The bicycle, motorcycle, three-wheeler Is that what sparked your interest in off-road?
Well, you know, I really don't know. When I was, I'm talking like super young, 2 or 3 years old, my dad had a Jeep, and my mom used to, and he'd get up and go to work and drive that Jeep. And she said I would get up and after I heard it start, it would wake me up and I'd be like, brum, brum, dad. And so my dad actually, I think, started me kind of with the four-wheel drive thing. You know, as soon as I was big enough to sit on his lap and hold on to the steering wheel, he was letting me try and steer the non-power steering thing and told me to keep my thumbs and fingers out of the wheel and, you know, crawl around in granny gear.
Was that a flat fender or five or?
It was a CJ5.
Okay.
I don't remember the year, but I think my mom's got pictures of me sitting in it when I was 2 or 3 years old.
That's cool.
But so, you know, that's probably where it started. Is that, and, you know, my dad, he showed me a lot of stuff as I was growing up and, you know, how to work on things. The correct tools to use, things like that. It was, so my dad always had, had projects and things that I learned from.
Okay. What did your dad do for work?
Well, he actually kind of started as a draftsman.
Okay.
He had an engineering degree and he started as a draftsman for a window company. And he kind of moved his way up there to kind of management position. And then at some point, he got the opportunity to buy this business it's custom window business for residential homes.
Okay.
And he got the opportunity to buy it and kind of take it to the next level. So he's been pretty much in the custom home window business his whole life, although he always was working on vehicles and his thing was kind of Corvettes. He taught me how to paint and how to work on fiberglass, and we built my first car together and taught me a lot of stuff. Definitely got me on my way.
Excellent. What was your first car?
Actually, I still own my first car. It's a 1969 RS Camaro. We went, I kind of, at a young age, I started working when I was real young. Had my own little lawn mowing business and worked at a tropical fish store. And this was around 11 or 12 years old. And because I wanted cooler bicycle parts, so I needed to make some money, right?
Right, yep.
And I had saved a bit of money, and my dad and me went over to Pomona, California. I don't even know if they still have the Pomona swap meet, but it was quite the big thing for many, many years. And ended up at one point buying this old 69 Camaro, and it was pea green but pretty free of rust, and most of it was there. And it was a 307 car, but it was the RS, and it had most of the parts, and took it home and started. I took some painting classes at a local paint supply store, and my dad had taught me a little bit, and then so we did all the body and paint, and it was a frame off, well, subframe off, I guess, and learned how to build a motor and learn how to kind of put a whole vehicle together, you know, cleaning and making parts as pretty as I could.
Excellent. Excellent. And then while you were in school, what kind of classes did you take? I mean, I know everybody takes the math and the reading and that kind of stuff, but like elective wise.
Right. You know, and I keep kicking myself, I think a little bit, because now I'm living in Mexico for a good part of every year and I never took any language classes. It was always wood shop or metal shop or mechanic shop or, you know, anything to do with, you know, working with your hands.
Right. Well, I took 2 years of Spanish, 2 years of German, and the only thing I can do in either is order beer and find the bathroom. Which I figured if you can buy the beer, order the beer, you better know where the bathroom's at.
That's right. Yeah, so you didn't do very well with your what were they called?
The foreign languages?
Well, yeah, those kind of classes.
Yeah, my thing was is I did really well in them, but I don't think my retention was really good.
Yeah. It's not something you wanted to retain.
Yeah, I think it had something to do with growing up in the early 70s and being near a big city like San Francisco and some of the things that came along with that.
Right. Yeah, I get that. But that kind of just added to what my dad had been teaching me and what I'd been learning on my own. And so I took those types of classes in high school anyway.
Right. Did you do any college?
Yeah, I did. I did some college, but I never got an official degree. I just took the classes that I thought were going to, forward me into what I was interested in. Welding and mathematics and some engineering stuff and AutoCAD and things like that.
Right. And did you, in school, would you consider yourself studious or were you more, did you do any athletics, organized athletics, or did you kind of do your own thing? You said you skated. So I figured that if you did any skating, then you probably were like doing your own thing.
Well, you know, I did baseball and soccer and I did wrestling, and somewhere shortly around there, I started getting into girls, and that changed everything, right?
Yeah.
Now, after you get into girls, then you're like, well, now I got to do this to be cool, and I got to get more girls, so I got to do more of this, and yeah. So it veered off from sports to girls.
Did your grades suffer going from sports to girls? I know mine did.
I always thought school was kind of easy. So I could make any grades I wanted, really. I think I graduated with a 3.5 out of 4.0. School, I wasn't super interested in school, but man, girls and cars, that I was interested in.
Perfect. So then you were mowing lawns to get to where you could work on your 69. At that point, did you continue doing that through that time, or did you find other jobs to do?
Well, I was very fortunate that my parents had a home with an extra single garage that my dad had turned into a paint booth. And since I had learned how to paint on my car and went through some painting classes, auto body and stuff, I started, painting cars, doing body and paint. And, so I could make a good money doing that.
And, yeah.
I would also, I guess at 16, I started buying and selling vehicles. I'd buy something, an old turd and polish it up. And I mean, you could, I don't remember how many I turned, but I always bought and sold, you know, a vehicle, and I'd make it cool, you know, where people wanted it, and I'd sell it before I crashed it usually.
Perfect. I can't say that I did that. I normally crashed them.
Yeah, no. When I got into Jeeps, I could crash them, and I'm sure all of you guys know Shannon Campbell, but we kind of grew up together, and we'd get a bucket of chicken and a case of beer, and we'd look at the maps and go out for the weekend, and we'd usually roll a Jeep over at least once and tear shit up, and then we'd come back and patch it back together so we could get to school or and our jobs and learned how to fix them pretty quick.
So you and Shannon both went to Gilbert High together?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we did.
Awesome. And how far behind was Nick? Is the younger brother, right? So he was.
Yeah.
He's a couple of years behind you guys.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he's a couple, I guess. That sounds about right.
Okay. So Shannon Campbell as a high schooler. I haven't had a chance to interview Shannon yet, so I've got to ask, what was he like?
Oh, man, back in the day, I think all of us were wild.
Right.
I mean, all we wanted to do was have fun, get loose on the weekend, make more money so we could fix up our rigs. And, we were all pretty wild, that's for sure.
Now, I know Don was racing.
Yeah.
And Shannon got into it at around that age. Did you do that as well?
I did get into racing also, pretty early. Don was it was nice to have him around and teach us. And I remember one of the first times I met Don, I had earrings in my ears and long hair, and he said, "Let me get a hold of that hair. I'm gonna rip those earrings out of your ears."
That's Don.
yeah. But it was a good influence on teaching us how to do some of the racing stuff, and great guy.
Yeah, I will say that Don has poisoned me a few times with his love for whiskey.
That's
great. Don's a great guy.
Yeah, but one of the things that set early was, if you boys are going to play, you got to learn how to fix them.
Correct. True.
So we did a lot of playing and a lot of fixing.
So back in that time, you're flipping cars. You had a Jeep then as well, four-wheel drive, or was it truck?
So I had a 69 Camaro.
Right.
And I didn't have it too long before I went to a desert party and it got all dirty. And I thought, man, I want to go out here and play in the dirt. And so I ended up buying, an old, let's see, what year was it? Actually, it wasn't that old at the time. It was a 1980 CJ5, and it had the straight six in it. And first thing I did with that thing pretty much was lift it and put bigger wheels and tires on it. And the second thing I did with it was learn how to drive it on two wheels. And the third thing I did with it was roll it over.
did that learning to drive on two wheels and roll over all happen within like a couple hundred feet, or was it or was it a process?
It was a process. I don't know. You got to take one with the other.
Right. So, what was the area that you guys, you know, went looking for those trails or roads and stuff? Was that in the Gilbert area, or did you guys get out past Apache Junction at that point?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we had desert parties. We, you know, kegger parties out in the desert, and And so we'd go out and have some beers we'd have our Jeeps and trucks. And then it was, well, let's go play in the dirt. Let's go play in the desert, have a few beers under your belt and you go out and you do stupid things and you get them stuck and tip them over or whatever. And then you figure out how to get them unstuck because you got to get back home. So it kind of started there and then it got to, we'd have a weekend off and we weren't working and we'd just look at a map and we'd go, oh man, let's see if we can make it to here. And we'd go and sometimes we'd drive in circles, but it was always just exploring further and further as much time as we had, before we had to be back to work or back to school or whatever it was.
Nice. What was the transition from those days and painting cars to fabbing? Or did it just happen from like doing the body work and then it just started getting deeper and deeper?
Yeah. Well, when you really tear stuff up or you want something to do what you can't afford to pay somebody to do, you kind of figure out how to make it happen. My dad had an old buzz box, arc welder, and I'd learned how to arc weld. And then at some point he bought a MIG welder and, I wasn't really allowed to touch that, but I did when he wasn't looking right. And then, so you kind of start by repairing what you're tearing up and then you, if I could just make this go this. And so you start cutting, you got a torch and chop saw and a welder and man, you start making things and figuring out how to do things. And you go take it out, oh man, I got 2 more inches of lift or whatever. You cut things to make bigger tires and then take it out and see that it either worked or it didn't work. And so it kind of started just by trial and error, but trying to make stuff go as good as I wanted to, I guess, or go where I wanted to go.
And with, say, like that CJ5,
uh-huh,
it's leaf sprung.
Yeah.
When did you go from the stock suspension to, start cutting things up and trying different things besides just lifting them? Was it on that vehicle or a different one?
Well, no, actually on that one, I owned many CJ5s actually, but the first one I did a spring over on it, which causes all kinds of other problems. So you have to figure out how to work with those. Because a spring over was cheaper than buying springs and a lift kit, right?
Right.
And you'd find some shocks somewhere or something and make shock mounts, and it just kind of progressed. I mean, we messed up, or I messed up so many things, made so many mistakes, but that's how you learn. And then somebody else would say, I got a broken this, or I got a broken frame, or I got a broken this, and I can fix that for, a case of beer, or I can fix that for $25, or, fill my tank full of gas, and pretty soon you're the guy that knows how to run a welder, and I don't know, you kind of make it up as you go, and some of it works and some of it doesn't.
So how did I want to get to the Red Racer, but I want to know the progression to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think others would want to know your progression from, the CJ5s and sprung over to getting to a full independent car that was kind of, to me, it's the first one I could remember.
Yeah,
is that correct?
It is correct. That is the first front and rear independent suspension rock crawler that was competing. They know, as far as I know. Then, you know, Shannon had a front independent suspension one, and then shortly after, Walker had a front and rear independent suspension one, and so we were all playing with whatever we could, you know, coming up with different ideas and trying stuff. But way before that, it was kind of trying to perfect the spring over. Figuring out what worked best in the front, you know, whether the shackle in the front or the shackle in the back, and how to get the steering geometry correct. We didn't have bump steer, and so building knuckles and for crossover steering, and making pockets in the frame for different mounts, and then this would get in the way, and you would change that, and of course the whole time you're going from, you know, you start with 31s and then you're at 32s and then you're 33s. And then, man, they came out with these super swamper boggers, 35s. And I think me and Mike Flores and Shannon Campbell and Ned Bacon and, I don't remember. There was, and Rick Payway, we all had these boggers. And man, those tires tore up more crap than so we all kind of tore up a lot of stuff and learned, you know, how to keep that stuff from breaking. And of course, then it progressed to, I started with just, a flat 4x8 table and a tubing bender and some 1¾" 120 wall mild steel tube, and started from scratch. And at first I'd bought a flat fender. It was an early CJ2A. It was a 1945.
Well, okay.
And I ended up the only thing I used from that Jeep was the title and the VIN tag. And ended up putting a CJ7 body on it. And you know, that Jeep is still floating around somewhere, but it was probably first that I knew of that was 4-link coilover suspension. I had custom coilovers built. I started working at a place in Phoenix called FST. Okay. And those guys that worked there, they were all desert racers. And they were like, you rock crawling faggot, what are you doing? You know, well, I'm playing in the dirt, playing in the rocks, going slow. But anyways, I learned a lot from those guys. And that was Rick and Jeff Geyser brothers. And they, you know, we all kind of worked together back then. But it was fun. I learned a lot from them and tailored things to what I was doing with my vehicles. And I did some off-road racing at the time as well with that vehicle. They just progress and you learn from, you know, your mistakes, of course. But, by that time I was also working at a place we built, it was called Capital Vans and Equipment, and a guy named Ken. And he was a real neat guy, and he taught me a bunch about metal and what you could and couldn't do with it. We'd take brand new trucks, cut the frames, extend them, and put tow truck beds on them. We built wheelchair vans and, you know, pretty much anything he could take in, but it was mostly wheelchair vans and tow trucks. And then I was working at that FST place kind of as a second job, but just learning and anytime I had time off, I'd take my shit out and tear it up.
And this was mid-90s, early-90s?
This was mid-90s. I did let's see, with my sprung over, I guess as far as I took a CJ5, I did Top Truck in 1995. Yeah, 1995. I think the first Top Truck was 93 or 94. And I did it in 95. And that was a lot of fun. And that introduced me to a lot of the guys that I'm still friends with today. That were judges at the time or been working with the magazines or stuff like that. But that was a great experience, but that was as far as I took a leaf spring vehicle. And after that, it was, I think exactly after that, I'd already started on the chassis for my tube chassis, coilover, four link Jeep. And the next year they invited me back as a judge. And I drove that Jeep from Phoenix up to Hollister. And then we all played, and then we judged the thing and had fun. And I think that was the year that Shannon entered in it. And anyways, then it went from, I guess, that vehicle, that tube chassis Jeep, I competed off-road desert racing with it. That's kind of when rock crawling started. I think the first big one I had entered was, I think it was called a BF Goodrich rock crawling competition. And that was in New Mexico. And I think that was like 98 maybe.
Yeah. I think that was the very first one. That was the Las Cruces or Farmington. Yep.
Well, you know what? It kind of runs together. It was one of those two, but it was in New Mexico. So okay. It was definitely one of those two places.
It was the first one. The first one was down there in Las Cruces.
Right. Yeah. I don't really remember where it was at, but it was one of the first ones. And then, before that we had tough truck competitions and whatever I guess I could get into to go race and compete and tear stuff up.
From the 7, you built the chassis, you put it all together. What kind of components did you run back then? I mean, I know most of the stuff was things that you would pick up in salvage yards or
yeah, you know, we could buy a vehicle and salvage it ourselves, sell off the parts, or use some of them for, because I think I had another truck by then. But they called it the Tube Terror in one of the early magazines, but it was, really the only custom, high end parts were and they were 2-inch coilovers with, I had 17-inch travel shocks built, and everyone thought I was nuts. They're like, what are you going to do with a 17-inch travel? How are you going to get the coils to stack? So I learned a lot about how to do, then we called it triple rate, but it was a dual rate coil with a very soft, small one at the top just to keep the coils, from being loose at full extension. But the rest of that Jeep was built parts or salvaged parts. I mean, I was using Dana axles. I had a semi-float Dana 60 in the rear and a Dana 44 in the front. It was a 205 transfer case, a turbo hydromatic 350 transmission, and a small block Chevy. And I don't remember the first motor that I had in there, but I had a couple different ones. And I think the last one was probably 400, maybe a little over 400 horsepower or something like that, fuel injected. But you started off building your own everything. But to go to racing, we had to do a couple of things. We had to have a fuel cell, which you could buy from a stock car. You could buy a fuel cell pretty cheap. And we had to have, good seats and belts and a few things like that. But man, we used factory gearboxes and mounted them in strange locations to try to get the geometry correct. And you kind of just built everything.
It was so much experimentation back then because there was nobody. I mean, it was the beginning of it all. It was, you know, the cutting edge, so to speak.
Yeah. I don't know how cutting edge it was, but we were experimenting. I mean, there
experimenting,
was
experimenting. Exactly.
There was a handful of us, and when we get a chance, we'd go out and we'd go to the Hammers way before it became the Hammers. But Sledgehammer was the first trail out there, and a bunch of old guys and CJs kind of opened up this trail. And they were hardcore rock crawlers on 33-inch tires. And then, you know, we showed up. I don't know who all, you know, a handful of us showed up with these 35-inch boggers. And we all had pretty beat up the body anyway, beat up sheeps by then. And these old guys kind of looked at us and said, go ahead and give it a shot. And so we kind of, you know, started with Sledgehammer and then, and helped open up, I think it was Jackhammer or something, and just out doing the most extreme things we could find. And that was, and shortly after that is when the rock crawling competition started.
And you started competing back in those days, the very beginning, and you were running, the seven, your two buggy seven then?
I guess my first, I don't really remember, Rich. Okay. I think my first competition was probably Top Truck Challenge in 1995, with my leaf sprung CJ5.
Right.
But I had already had the tube chassis Jeep, you know, I'd already started that, but that was the one that I started competing with.
Okay.
Was the tube chassis Jeep, and you know, kind of just took off. I guess took off from there. You know how everything is now.
Yep. Who spotted for you back then?
Oh, geez. Yeah, it was whoever my drinking buddy was at that time. you know, it was kind of whoever I could get to go with me and could take a weekend off. I've had so many, you know, good friends that spotted for me or co-drove for me. And we were just learning as we went, but it was fun.
Right. Those early days, you were at the Cedar event. I think it was, I want to say it was 99, the ARCA event. The first event they did was down there in Arizona, or no, excuse me, Farmington, and then they did Arizona, and then Cedar City, or something like that. What did you think of that Cedar event? Because I was at the Arizona event there on Upper and Lower Woodpecker, and there was a lot of people there, but not like Cedar, and you know, Cedar, all of a sudden we had like, I mean, the sheriff estimated 10,000 people at that first event there. Did that kind of blow you away that it was how big it got so quick?
Yeah, you know, it did. It was like, wow, where did all these people come from? And why are they here watching us try to crawl over these rocks? And then we learned really quick. Well, I guess we learned from, you know, the very first competition, put on a show. And, so that was kind of the inside joke between a lot of us guys were like, whoever puts on the best show wins, not necessarily whoever wins. Right.
Right.
And so I don't know. I mean, it was, you know, it was peeling out and making dust and rolling over. And I mean, we tried to do good too, but it was about putting on a show. It was fun. Especially, I mean, in front of, you know, the crowds like that.
Right.
But, so you were there to entertain, and that's kind of what we did.
How did you get started at, was it Four Wheeler Supply?
Yeah, Four Wheeler Supply.
Four Wheeler Supply.
Well, I had already been working at FST part-time, and then I was working full-time building tow trucks and vans and things, and I was also doing painting and, you know, whatever I could do to buy more parts and build more Jeeps and trucks. But one of Brian was managing the place, and one of Brian's friends came over to FST, and he talked to me and he said, hey, Randy, why don't you come over and look at this place and see if you think you might want to kind of get a fab shop going here and work for Brian. And I said, all right. So I went over and to Four Wheeler Supply and talked to Brian, and he's like, yeah, I kind of want to do some of the stuff you're doing, and we've got this barn over here, and I've got a guy over there, and he's got some equipment, and he's got some things going on, and I think the barn had, man, I think it had three light bulbs hanging from cords from the top of the barn, and it became called the dark side. But anyways, we did get some more lights in there, and there was a guy named Steve, and they had a race truck that they had bought, and he was working on that, kind of his own deal, just to kind of stay on that race truck. And I went over and started working for him, and just, you know, Four Wheeler Supply was, you know, they were the Jeep guys. And I had many, many Jeeps and been working on a lot of Jeeps and been fabbing on Jeeps and kind of knew a lot of the tricks, I guess, with them. And so I started kind of their fab shop for them over there. And although Steve had already had a fab shop there, they were just kind of just taking care of the race truck. And we worked on anything and everything over there, but a lot of Jeeps.
So who are some of the guys that came through there and worked in the fab shop that you basically started there?
Oh, well, I think a lot of you guys probably know Steve Nance,
yep.
Ian Liljeblad, Rob Bonney. Wow, there were so many guys. But those are the guys that come to my mind first.
Some pretty good names.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, they're all still, every single one of them are still playing with metal and Jeeps and trucks.
So then wheeling, competing, building, painting, kind of doing it all. And for how long did you continue doing that?
I stayed at Four Wheeler Supply. I really enjoyed working there. One of the last guys that was kind of working with me there was Rob Bonney. And Rob's a great guy, and he was doing a really good job. And I told Brian, I said, I think it's time for me to go on my own. And this was in like 2000, or late 99, 2000, something like that. And Brian wanted me to stay. And of course it was a great opportunity to stay there. But I knew that I couldn't push myself any harder working for somebody else. And I'd already had my own, shop. I had a house in Tempe, and, I already had my own shop, and I was running myself ragged working at Four Wheeler Supply. And then I'd go home every night, and I'd work till midnight, you know, working on other people's stuff. And then, at some point it was just like, you know what, I think it's time for me to go on my own. And Brian was understanding, and although he would like me to stay there, but he was understanding, and he said, all right. And I said, you know, Rob's, he's doing a great job, and I'm pretty sure that he can handle everything that's going on here. And And of course Rob did, and I left and went on my own, and I worked out of my house till from, I guess, 2000 or so to 06, when I was so busy and it was so crazy out of my house. I had semi trucks coming daily, picking stuff up. We were doing production work for Casey Highlights. We were doing production work for construction companies. We were doing, we were doing full chassis, full builds. I even built a monster truck out of my house. It was just, it just got kind of crazy. The whole inside of my house, Rich, I had a kitchen, a bathroom, and my bedroom. And this was a 3-bedroom home. And all the rest of the house was packaging, shelving, for all the parts we were building. And, I don't know how many guys I had working for me at one time, many guys, and this was out of my house. This is on a quiet neighborhood street, and, no HOA, but, I had a forklift, I was loading and unloading semis in the front, and I had an alley in the back and a 30-foot gate, and we'd unload the steel truck in the back or sometimes in the front. And we were building trailers. I mean, you name it, we'd build it. And finally it got so crazy that, I decided to step up and I bought a 11,000 square foot facility in Phoenix. And that's when things got real, right?
Yep.
So business went to the next level and we stepped up to production. Casey Highlights was a huge customer of ours, and they really supported us and helped us out, and we reciprocated and built a lot of neat stuff for them. And other companies started coming online, I don't want to just name a bunch of names, but we started building parts for all the biggest places in the States, they wanted to concentrate on one thing, but they still had this other product line going, or they wanted new products made for this, that, and the other thing. And so we started building parts for, everybody.
So you were basically a job shop as well?
Yeah, we'd private label for them. I would do all the engineering, the drawings, the prototyping. Me and my guys, and then, they kind of at the end, depending on the deal, they would own the stuff, but they would have us produce it. And so we did everything, powder coating, packaging, labeling instructions, where they just pick up pallets and their parts were ready to go. And of course we were still doing custom builds, custom whatever, whether they were full builds or just bumpers or cages or whatever, but, whatever we could do, but, we really ramped up the production.
Was that Randy Ellis Design?
Yes, that was Randy Ellis Design. I guess it started as Randy Ellis Design in about 2001 is when I officially paid taxes under the name Randy Ellis Design.
Okay. And then you ran that business for how long?
Up until 2017.
Till 17.
Yeah.
And is that when you, I heard you got into boats. Was that correct?
I guess I've always been a little into boats. I remember being a kid and going out on a lake and, in Arizona with my grandpa and my family and catching fish, and my dad had a boat now and then. And then I've had a few speed boats, and those were always lake boats. In 2014, I was married to a wonderful lady named Sabina. And my idea was to get a sailboat, and at some point down the road, we just set off into the sunset, do something different, go travel the world. And so I said, let's buy a sailboat and go sailing. And she said, well, you probably should learn how to sail first. And I thought, no, you know, that's silly. I just get on the boat and figure it out, right? Well, she actually talked me into doing the sailing course out of La Paz, which is southern Baja.
Right.
And it was a 10-day course where we learned all about sailing, and we got some certificates, I don't know, 101, 102, 103, and something else. But it was actually a great start. Give you enough to hurt yourself, really. And kind of know what you're getting into. But then I did, shortly after that, I chartered a boat in Europe for 10 days. And then I ended up buying this old boat from this couple. They were in their 80s, and they were just done. And they'd kind of let the boat go, and I bought it cheap. And, of course, had to learn how to work on a sailboat and all its systems and everything like that. So, but, so the first time I had went sailing was 2014.
Nice. And have you ever seen the movie Chasing Bubbles?
I have. I'm not sure that's a movie though. Is that?
Well, I guess it's more like a documentary, but it's a YouTube, isn't it a YouTube or something?
Yeah, it was on YouTube, and I've seen that more than once. That's a pretty good, that's a good documentary.
Right.
For sure. Have you seen it?
Yes. I suggest for anybody that has that wandering gene, I would say, that wants to maybe get away from it all at some point and to explore, that they need to, that they should watch that.
Yeah, you know what got me kind of attracted early on was there was I forget what they call them now, but you read on the internet, and it's like
a blog?
A blog, yeah. Okay. It's a blog. It's called Bumfuzzle.
Bumfuzzle, okay.
Yeah, and it was early on before they had kids. That was just amazing, and that kind of was like, yeah, that's what I want to do. And it's about a guy and a girl that go out and they're eating pizza and have too much to drink and say, you know what, screw this. Let's buy a boat and sail around the world. And not knowing anything about it, that's what they did. And it was pretty cool.
So you're now living for part of the year. We had this conversation before we started recording, even the first time we tried to record. that you're living about 8 months a year on your boat. Is it still the same boat?
Yeah, it is. Okay. Same boat I bought in 2016. The name of my baby girl here is Simplify.
Simplify. There you go.
Yeah, she's a 36 and a half foot cutter rigged monohull sailing boats, 1980. It's an old heavy fiberglass boat, and I've been living on her for 8 to 10 months a year, sailing around all the Pacific coast of Mexico and the Sea of Cortez and Baja since 2017.
Awesome. You said you were down as far as Guatemala. Have you left the West Coast, the Pacific?
I have not.
Okay.
As everybody knows, things got a little crazy the last couple of years, and Central America shut down. And I kind of I waited it out for a little while, tried to get into Central America, and it just wasn't looking good. So I ended up buying a truck, and I've been just driving all over Mexico for the past year and a half or so. And then I'm in the Puerto Vallarta area right now in a place called The Cruz. I'm in a marina actually right now, which I don't spend a lot of time in usually, but right now I am. And so I flew back down to my boat and sailed it back up from Chiapas up to the Puerto Vallarta area. And that's where I'm at now.
And what's the next step?
Well, that's the best part. I don't know. I'm I really do want to go and explore Central America, Panama, and then probably through the canal, play around in the Caribbean, and who knows. But I still spend, 4 months a year or so in the States in my truck, four-wheeling and camping. When it just gets, when I get done sailing, I'm just tired of it or it's too hot. That's kind of what I do, is go get in my truck and go four-wheeling.
Well, we'll need to stay in touch so that when you get to where you're heading down to Latin America, down Central America, if you get into Costa Rica, I've got some friends in Capos. And the big marina there is run by a friend of mine, Carter. And Sam Munford, she runs the a prop shop there for some of the big fishing boats and charter boats, where they, she's got the only computerized drive shaft and prop balancer in Latin, in that all of Central America. And so you get down that way, they're good people to know, that's for sure. Great people, all expats down in that area. And then Sam's, Samantha's husband is a charter captain down there on a fishing boat, so charter boat. So pretty cool.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I will definitely be spending time in Costa Rica as I go down, for sure. So I'll definitely look you up and get their numbers.
Yeah, and then
I understand that we talked a little bit that you're living on a boat part of the time now.
Yeah, we have a power boat. No, we're not into sail yet. We are on our starter boat, or beginner boat, I guess you would call it. We really like it. I love the layout and the design and how much room we have. We're used to living in kind of a small space with the last 10, 11 years living in our semi-truck converted RV. But the, so living small works really well for us. So we are looking at possibly like a cat, something in that line instead of a monohull. But, or we'll find something like what we have, but with diesel engines in it instead of the gas motors. It was right. One of the things when we decided to buy a boat, it was kind of last minute. 3 weeks later, we had a boat. It was, it wasn't like a long drawn out process.
Right. Well, I guess if you thought about it too much, you might not do it, but man, it's, how do you like living on the water?
I love it. Absolutely right? Love it. Yes. It's relaxing. There's still a lot, we're in a marina. There's a lot that goes on around us, especially with all the charter fishing boats that go out and the tour boats and the shipping channels right here for Corpus Christi. So there's just a lot of activity, yet we don't have to. And then, right across from the marina is the like row of bars and restaurants and everything. So we can hear people having a good time and, the girls that are drunk that are, woohoo, and all that kind of stuff, but we don't have to worry about getting thrown up on.
Right. Exactly.
So that's kind of nice.
Yeah. And how's the weather there where you're at right now?
The weather has been good. Every Thursday we've been getting a small cold front that comes in and knocks 20 degrees off of our typical temperature of like 70. And, we got another one coming in this Thursday, but it's, our whole idea was trying to just chase 70.
Right.
And it's, you know, we like this area because it's middle of the country. We can, you know, jump in our pickup truck or the semi truck that's parked 4 hours away and go anywhere we want really quick. Where if we were down in Florida, we'd have a lot longer trip to get there. But, you know, that's, I do like Florida. We went through that area last year, during COVID, November, December of 2020. And it was the first time I'd been down to the Keys and all that. And that's when we decided, once we bought the boat, it was like, okay, we're going to go do the loop. So we want to do the Great Loop here in probably 2024. And then we'll head from here down around, catch the, you know, around the Keys and then up the Eastern Seaboard into the Great Lakes, across the Erie Canal, and then down the river systems. And that'll probably take, we'll probably do it in like two sessions. I don't want to rush any of it. That's the whole idea, is to take time. And these guys that go, I did it in 46 days. Well, congratulations. What did you see? You know, it's
right. Yeah. Take at least a couple years to do that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh man, that'll be a great adventure. I hope you get to do that soon.
Yep. We will. So then, you're just living the life that the name of your boat is. You've simplified.
That's right. Yeah. I'm living a pretty simple life now, and I don't have much of a schedule. Although I have been still racing the Baja 1000, driving for a guy that I sold my last race car to, but, not much else on the schedule. I kind of do a lot of exploring. I've got a truck here that I do a lot of inland and you know, exploring and hiking and surfing and just, of course, a lot of sailing and fishing and having a good time. It's basically summer here is all winter. It's summer. And then I call my winters when I go up in the mountains in the summertime in the States. I go up to Colorado or Utah and Idaho and things like that, and go ride dirt bikes and go four wheeling and do a bunch of camping. But that's my winter, the couple months doing that.
That's awesome. It's, I'm glad to hear that you're enjoying life and doing it your way.
Oh man. Yeah. Thank you. And I am. It's awesome.
So
sorry, not sorry.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm going to turn 64 in March, and you know, the last 21 years have been spent putting on events. So I've had a lot of time to travel, but not necessarily the way I've wanted to travel. I got to see a lot of things, got to meet a lot of people, but it's the time is coming here real soon where, you know, we're not going to have that kind of schedule. You know, at least the schedule I had, I made, you know, it wasn't somebody else dictating what I had to do, but I want to go without a schedule.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I really don't know what today is of the week, which is pretty cool.
That's
awesome.
I kind
of say every day is a Saturday. But Rich, don't wait, man. Don't wait till it's too late.
Nope. Not going to.
We're good.
We've brought a partner in that purchased half of We Rock, and with the intent that they're going to take it over in the next year or two. And so we'll be working more from the background after this next season, which will be nice. It'll be able to free us up to do more of what we want to do. And it's time.
Heck yeah. Good deal, man. That's kind of strange to hear that you're also doing the boat thing. And, you know, you probably remember Sonny Honegger.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he's in the Azores right now. He's also doing the boat thing. He's got a 1898 wooden gaff rigged boat that he's bringing across I think he brought it from France. He's bringing it across over to, he's going to end up in the Northeast, I think somewhere around Maine.
Holy shit. An 1898? Yeah. 1898
is when this boat was commissioned. Wow. Yeah, it's an old wooden boat. And hopefully in a few months, I'll go sail with him from, I guess it's the Azores over to Iceland. So we'll see what happens about that. But that'd be pretty cool.
Wow, that's awesome. So
yeah,
when you're talking to Sonny next time, tell him that I would love to have him on the podcast and talk to him about his history as well. He's one of those that a lot of people mention. And I knew that he was going to be pretty difficult to get hold of, but I didn't know how to chase him down. Now I do. So that's awesome.
I can give you his number. Yeah, we still talk all the time.
Perfect.
Yeah, he was, and Sonny's a real innovator. So
yes,
he's definitely somebody that I'm sure a lot would like to hear
absolutely
about.
Well, Randy, I want to say thank you so much for spending the time and being patient with me for screwing up the first 10 minutes of our conversation. But
yeah, man, no big deal. It's actually been great, you know, kind of talking old times and. I'm sure we could go on for hours, actually.
Absolutely, but we'll have to
the more we talk about it, the more you start thinking, oh yeah, I remember this and I remember that, and you know, as soon as we hang up, we're both going to go, oh shit, we forgot to talk about that.
true. Yeah. So you know, thank you for coming on board. Let's stay in touch because I would like to, you know, if you get over to the Caribbean, that would be awesome. And maybe we could hook up and enjoy some time together and, you know, maybe drink a drink or two with those little umbrellas in it. Although yeah, it doesn't have to have the umbrella.
Right. Wouldn't that be fun though?
Yes.
All right. Well, all we got to do is make it happen.
That's true. All right. Randy,
right
thank
on,
you
Rich.
So much.
Thank you so much. All okay. right. You take care, buddy.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
If you enjoy these podcasts, please give us a rating. Share some feedback with us via Facebook or Instagram, and share our link among your friends who might be like-minded. Well, that brings this episode to an end. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll catch you next week with Conversations with Big Rich. Thank you very much.